Now, the year is 1926, and Sarah, in the flower of her womanhood, meets Henry Welkin, who has a profound and lasting impact on her and indeed on Saskatchewania. Professor Matheson, perhaps you could read from Paul Hebert's account of that fateful meeting.
Sure. Literature owes much to Henry Welkin. It must forever stand to his credit that it was through his influence that Sarah was brought into contact with the great world of commerce and culture. And then he goes on talking about Welkin, and he points out that in spite of his success as a traveling salesman, Henry Welkin was not a man of action. His disposition tended to be retiring, as is shown by the remark of one of his contemporaries in the drugstore. I'm quoting, "Hank sure hates himself," close quote. On the other hand, as a traveling salesman, he had acquired from much travel a certain urbanity and carried himself with an air. We're not told what the air is. He was not unpopular. The maids at the commercial house invariably fluttered upon his arrival. Moreover, at Charlie Wong's Snooker Academy, his athletic prowess was recognized, and he was able to win from the youth of Willows no less nor more than their unstinted admiration.
Quite a guy.
Obviously a charismatic
fellow. All in all. And he appears to have had a tremendous influence on Sarah. They sported about Regina for a week. Regina, by the way, is described as the Athens of Saskatchewan throughout the book.
True, yeah. But the biographer is quite quick to deny any suspicion of a romantic attachment having sprung up between the two.
Well, he's too close to his subject, obviously.
He may well be, but perhaps out of an attempt to be faithful to the highest memory of Sarah, but he does sidestep the issue of any kind of sexual congress taking place in Regina.
Well, something certainly must have happened, because immediately after returning from the trip to Regina, she enters into her dark hour.
The dark night of Sarah's soul.
The dark night, which is referred to for no particular reason as Darkest Africa by Hebert. There are some wonderful examples of the poetry that followed. On page 92 of the biography, there's a wonderful snippet that I wonder if one of you would share with.
"With grief engraven on my soul, I cannot roll in glee. The robin's note is but a dirge. The biscuit bird grits me."
What is a biscuit bird?
And how does one grit someone else?
So she found it in the Collier's Encyclopedia, 1909, under B for bird. There's just a list of birds. And this one had
enough syllables.
It had the syllables she needed. Well, yeah.
This uncanny ability to just find the right image.
Yeah. But she does the talented thing of taking what is normally a noun, grit, and transforming it into a verb.
Amazing.
Yeah. Impacting on the reader, that's
right.
So to speak.
Dialoguing well.
Yeah. A little interface with the with the language there.
And the roller coaster of her career continues. She receives, in spite of the Darkest Africa period, she goes on to receive recognition and fame. She wins the Swine and Kine Horse Thermometer Trophy, which, in fact, goes on to later impact, if I may, on her life in a significant way, plays a part in her untimely death.
Has a very ironic effect on her.
Yeah, mercury poisoning.
Mercury poisoning for a mercurial career. And she also wins the zenith of her career, winning the Wheatpool Medal.
That's true.
For Up From the Magma. I wonder if we already have, in fact, read somewhat from Up From the Magma. I wonder if we could give our listeners another dollop of that.
Now, this is
bit.
A tough one. It starts with several words that none of us know any longer. In
Or ever did.
Now, if you pronounce these very carefully, in schist and schistose rocks are writ the bands for him whose eye can runic read and cast the other optic upward till it spans in tortured gaze the future and the past. Isn't there a guy who sits with one eye on the pot and the other eye up the chimney? It's like that, isn't it? For such a one, that panoramic view shows rock to soil and soil to groat and greens. Nay, such a one already smells the stew of beet and barley bubbling with the beans.
Well, but I think the Old English influence is particularly
that's right. It's that Old English alliterative influence.
Runic.
Yeah,
yes, you can see. And there's the hint, too.
Runic reed and schist and schiktos and beet, barley, bubbling, and beans, all in one line. I mean, that doesn't happen by accident. That's craft.
She's obviously been influenced by the Beowulf poet, I I think perhaps so. I'll write an article on the subject.
Yes, please do. Mr. Drool. Yes.
And, of course, bringing her career to an end, she was the winner of the Swinenkine Horse Thermometer Trophy at the fair in Regina. And, sure enough, the hives strike Saskatchewan, a terrible outbreak. And she, parallel to that, had developed a love for mints and was chewing on a mint and trying to take her temperature with her horse thermometer and bit the wrong thing and died of mercury poisoning.
It's amazing how the deaths of great people are often sort of absurd. It reminds you of the Greek tragedian Aeschylus, who allegedly died when an eagle that was carrying a turtle in its talons dropped the turtle and it fell on Aeschylus's head, dispatching him.
Wasn't there
a kind of history
an American
repeats itself.
Poet who fell off the back of a train, too? It's, you know, death is absurd at the best of times, and mercury poisoning is nothing to be funny about, is it? It's
absolutely
a serious,
not serious
business, especially if you mix mercury with the magma.
And the mint.
And they all have alliteration, too. There's a poem in this.